Welcome to episode 3 of the Injamara podcast. I'm Jack Jacobs.
And I'm Stan Grant.
Stan, how are you going today?
Yeah, good, Jack. You know, things are starting to heat up, aren't they?
They are.
Don't you think? I mean, I've just been watching the various arguments coming together and the lines being drawn around the voice discussion. And what last year was a sort of nebulous debate, or wasn't even a debate, was a fairly sort of nebulous, even esoteric conversation around a voice and what it might mean, and it was wrapped up in the language of reconciliation and coming together and all of these, frankly, often meaningless terms. It's getting heavier. There's weight to the argument now, and you can see where the battle lines are going to be. There are clearly people who, for ideological reasons, political reasons, cultural reasons, are just coming out and going, no, right? There's just people who are just saying no. We're starting to see all the old wounds of history being opened up again. As an Aboriginal person, I'm starting to feel the tension around this. I'm starting to feel it personally. It feels personal to me. This is no longer now a discussion about a voice to Parliament and what it might mean. This is starting to feel like Australia's voting on me, voting on my people. It's existential. It's not just political. I think I'm starting to feel the weight of that.
What is the way, Stan, to have this debate, this necessary debate, without making that weight heavier than it needs to be on you and your
it's
people? It's beyond this country. So what do you mean by that?
I think the way that Australia is framed, the language that we've used to describe our history, the forgetting of Australian history.
The Great Australian Silence.
Yeah, the Great Australian Silence, as Stanner said. Australia is not equipped for this conversation. You know, I was recently in the United States, and in the US, the space is contested.
Right.
History is contested. Now, we know that it's blood-stained and it's deeply racist. And yet people rub up against each other. The voices are clamoring to be heard. The stakes are high. What's at stake is the very idea of America. In Europe, blood-stained history of the 20th century, the old wounds, the festering resentments, the borders, you know, nationalism, race, whiteness. In Australia, it's almost like we're anaesthetized. It's almost like we've sort of stepped out of history. And I don't know whether it's our location, it's our distance, but there is a sense here that we don't carry the weight of that as heavily as we should. And I don't think we're equipped, Jack, to come to these conversations as honestly and as robustly, as dangerously as we should, because these are, you know, we need to be vulnerable and we need to come to these ideas that are dangerous ideas and come to them with the goodwill and the good faith to steer our way through the dangerous waters, through the rocky waters, but never step back from the questions of justice and history and what is fundamentally right. And we don't have that conversation. In many ways, people are still trying to just silence it. Stop it. You know, stop it at the gate. Aboriginal sovereignty, no. Reparations, no. Rights, no. And yet we're prizing open that space anyway. So it's a test. It's a test for the country, I think.
Well, we're about to have this conversation now with a very thoughtful person, Professor Dominic O'Sullivan, who is working in this realm of ideas, of dangerous ideas. And in part, what we're trying to do here, Stan, is essentially return ideas to the Australian conversation about who we are as a nation.
In terms of identity. Doesn't like to do.
We don't like ideas, do we?
No, we don't. We're not. I think in Australia there is a sense, it goes back to this anaesthetizing silence.
Right.
There is a sense, I think, that it's self-indulgent. that history is for other countries.
With the capital H history.
Yeah, we're practical. We get on with things. You know the John Williamson song, tie it up with wire, keep the show on the road. There's a lovely practical element to Australia that makes Australians particularly useful, especially in a crisis. You know, you see with natural disasters.
And resilience.
Well, there is definitely that character. But the flip side of that is that we shy away from the things of the soul. We shy away from the things of the mind. We don't want to have those conversations because that's a little bit indulgent, but we need to. And so we're really being challenged with this. And as Aboriginal people, it'd be like stepping out of my skin to step outside of these arguments. This is who I am. So I'm really feeling that now. And I think that's what's so exciting about Dominic, is that Dominic knows the pathway, right? New Zealand, for all its faults, and there are many, and there are race issues. The New Zealand has walked a different path to us. Treaty, sovereignty, the rights of Maori people, the way that the role of the crown here extinguished our rights. The crown there joins its sovereignty to Maori sovereignty. So different. And so he's going to take us on a journey into what may well have been an alternate history for Australia and the road never taken.
Our guest today on the podcast is Dominic O'Sullivan. He's Professor of Political Science at Charles Sturt University and Adjunct Professor at the Auckland University of Technology. Dominic is a world-leading researcher in comparative Indigenous politics and public policy and the author of several books, the most recent of which, Indigeneity, Culture, and the UN Sustainable Development Goals, will be published in May this year. Dominic, so great to have you on the podcast. Welcome.
Thank you.
Dominic, hi.
Hi, Stan.
Hey, listen, we're starting to see the whole thing come together now around The Voice, and we're starting to have the conversation that we don't normally have or like to have in Australia about sovereignty. And I want to know for someone, a Maori person living in Australia with that ability to look at the two nations, why do you think Australians are so scared of the idea of First Nation sovereignty here? Why is it so easily framed as a radical idea or a threatening idea?
Well, the former Prime Minister of New Zealand and constitutional scholar Geoffrey Palmer described sovereignty as being like a piece of chewing gum. It can be stretched in any direction one wants, in any way one wants, to mean anything one likes, and therefore it should be banished from political discourse. And I understand where he's coming from, although I don't fully agree, but I do agree with the underlying sentiment that it's a confusing concept. It's often thrown around in discourse by people without giving it context to show what they understand it to mean. And therefore, it's commonly understood as an absolute political authority. So if I'm sovereign, you can't be.
Right.
If this person is sovereign, we can't be. And I think if we understand it in those absolute terms, it is a very scary concept because it pits people against one another in confrontation for what little scraps on the table they can find.
Well, Dominic, we know in reality that's what my people have experienced in Australia. The British said there is only one sovereign and we are extinguishing yours. And we've never accepted that. We have just never, and we never will. But what do we do then with the crown that extinguishes sovereignty and our place in this land, saying, no, we will not accept that?
Well, we think about sovereignty differently. And that opens up possibilities for not accepting that, while also allowing the state to continue to exist as a state, but on fundamentally different terms. And what I mean by that, and I referred to it in my book, Sharing the Sovereign, and that is a political idea of sovereignty as not belonging to the person of the king, not belonging to Parliament or the government of the day, but belonging to the people collectively. So ultimately, where does any kind of authority come from? It comes from the people. At least there's a moral argument one can make to say that that's where it should come from. So if sovereignty comes from the people, then we need to ask ourselves, which people? Some people or all people?
Okay.
If it's all people, does it have to be all people in the same ways? So I think, you know, there's a broad acceptance on the assimilationist side of the debate that First Nations people can share the sovereign if they're willing to abandon their cultures and to think and behave and act politically as white people.
And we're not going to do that.
And people quite reasonably say, we're not going to do that. We're not going to assimilate because its premise is to extinguish us, and we don't want to be extinguished. But we do want to have control over our own affairs. We want a voice in this society that has developed around us. And that is to share the sovereign. So a voice to Parliament is one aspect of that. It's not the idea in complete form, because no one institution, no one political practice or political thought can constitute the sovereign in its entirety. And that's important too, because, you know, sometimes in these sorts of debates, people say, well, we want everything or nothing. But nothing will give you everything. So a voice to Parliament is only part of that, and it has no bearing on the kind of sovereignty that the Uluru Statement describes, for example. And it really doesn't seem to me to have any bearing on the kind of sovereignty that Lydia Thorpe is describing. If the referendum...
Could I just ask you, just on that point, what do you see as the difference? The Uluru Statement talks about sovereignty and frames it very much in terms of an inheritance of ancestry and connection to place that is expressed in a spiritual, societal, cultural domain. Lydia and others are putting more weight into that. They're saying, yes, there is that conception, and there is also a hard political negotiation to be had around how we express that extant Aboriginal sovereignty. How do you see the distinction between, on the one hand, what the Uluru Statement may speak of, and on the other hand, what Lydia may speak of?
Well, I think, as you say, she takes the argument further, but the Uluru Statement's conception of sovereignty can exist with other forms of sovereignty. And it can exist also with the deeper political sovereignty that First Nations people might want to express. And I think that deeper sovereignty can be partly expressed through the voice, but also as people contemplate treaties and contemplate what they want from treaties, that's an important question to consider. What do we want treaties to achieve? What are the political rights and authorities that we want them to affirm and uphold? And that is, I guess, a further stage of a debate. It's a further discussion, I guess, about the scope of sovereignty. What does sovereignty mean?
What does this
if it belongs to the people, how does it belong to First Nations people in a material sense?
Yes, because Dominic, right now there's a lot of discussion around treaty, particularly because Lydia's left the Greens and is speaking in this sort of language, but also just because the Uluru Statement articulated it as being voice treaty truth. You know, it was a three-stage process, not just one ending at voice. A treaty presupposes that two sovereign parties come to negotiate, in my reading, and determine how they're going to coexist in their sovereignty. Is that correct? And if it is, what would a successful treaty in Australia look like for First Nations people, or series of treaties? We know that they're already underway in some states, but I'm thinking at a national federal level here in particular.
Well, firstly, treaty requires each party to recognise the political legitimacy of the other. So I think from a First Nations perspective, it's important to consider, well, what is it for us that would allow us to say the Australian state, the Commonwealth of Australia, is legitimate? And that's a huge thing to ask and to expect.
Yeah.
And many people might decide that's actually not possible. There is nothing that the Commonwealth of Australia could do to reconfigure itself in a way that makes it acceptable. And if that's the conclusion that people come to, then there really is no scope for treaties, unless it's a treaty of surrender. And people obviously are not going to want to do that. So what is it pragmatically and morally that would make the Australian state not just okay, but legitimate? And obviously one would expect substantive voices in the affairs of government, the voice to Parliament being part of that, perhaps the regional voices being a further part, but perhaps many other things as well. You know, political decisions are made all over the place. Sovereignty doesn't exist in just one place. It exists wherever there is an authority to make decisions that impact on people's lives. So what are the kinds of political arrangements that people think they need to have in order to have a voice in decision-making at every level?
Right.
Certainly in the, you know, at the highest levels. I mean, to have a treaty with no capacity to influence the executive or the parliament in a formal way, without, you know, the ability to vote in parliament, for example, would seem to me to be not particularly effective or not likely to lead to changes in policy outcomes. So these are the really, really hard questions that people are going to have to consider, I think, before considering what material outcomes a treaty might deliver.
Does this mean that it is much more difficult to do post-fact than it would have been at point of conflict, at point of contact, when we already have the state of Australia that exists as a sovereign entity recognised throughout the world? If we contrast that with New Zealand, you don't get New Zealand, do you, without the Treaty of Waitangi? So is it possible to do this now when we didn't do it at the point of contact as was done in New Zealand and other parts of the world?
It's extraordinarily more difficult because the political power that is the Commonwealth of Australia, that's an enormous political power, is well established. Prior to the Te Tiriti o Waitangi, there was no such thing as the New Zealand state. There was the British Empire wanting to expand itself, and there were independent Māori political communities across the country with no sense of a federal power that they shared among them. They were independent entities in the way that First Nations in Australia were at that time independent entities and seek to retain that identity. So certainly to do it before the fact of colonisation rather than, you know, 200 years into the colonial project is an awful lot easier. But I don't think that necessarily means that it can't be done.
Right.
But it is going to require extraordinarily goodwill on the part of both parties. There'll be extraordinary pressure on the Commonwealth not to recognise First Nations presence, not to, especially presence as political communities.
And to be bloody minded about it, Dominic, to be in a political sense, and we know where these things land politically. They land in the midst of culture wars, and they are connected with a whole lot of political agendas. Wouldn't the temptation and how easy it would be for a bloody minded approach to this to simply say no? We're not going to. And where does that leave us as First Nations people?
Well, that's right. And I think, you know, the National Party has said it's going to campaign against a voice because it favours an assimilationist model of politics. As a First Nations person, you can have your voice, but you've got to express it in a white person's way. That's a crude summary of the assimilationist argument or the assimilationist account of equality. So the National Party, as a mainstream political party, has ensures that that thought remains influential. It's not out on the fringe like Pauline Hanson's One Nation. It's a party that is regularly forms part of the government. So I would imagine the National Party's stance on the voice will logically lead it to being opposed to a treaty. The Green Party, one would imagine, will be fairly supportive, but it won't be in government and in a position to actually negotiate the terms of the treaty. For the ALP, always with its eye on the middle ground, who knows what could happen? I would suggest it would take a government that at the time is enjoying quite considerable political capital that it is willing to expend on this project to get a treaty that is anything more than symbolic.
To sit with the voice for a moment, Dominic, you know, we often hear this word recognition thrown around. And, you know, I was reading through some of your work previously to this conversation, and you frame recognition as a kind of political freedom, you know, the will of a collective people choosing to recognise a people distinct in their own sovereignty that can coexist with one's own. What does the voice say about recognition in a meaningful way? Is it meaningful in any way to you along the terms of recognition?
Not on its own, but I think it's an important component of something much bigger.
Right.
And one of the things that the voice will do is establish a body that can speak authoritatively about what the content of a treaty might be. A treaty at a national level, though, is further complicated by a number of things. Firstly, that the voice won't speak for everybody. There are many First Nations across Australia, and most of them won't be part of the voice. They'll contribute to electing its members, but just the numbers tell us that you can't have everybody there. So the treaties that we're seeing talked about in Victoria, for example, seem to make an awful lot more sense than a national treaty, because it's almost requiring the creation of a whole new political community of Indigenous Australia as a single entity. And, you know, one imagines a lot of people are going to contest that idea and find that, in a sense, to accept it, they've got to extinguish their own sovereignty in favour of a new one. So, and the other thing, too, is that the Commonwealth is not the original colonial power.
Yeah.
The original colonial power is the successor, the states, the successor to the colonial governments. So there's a logic in terms of treaties being negotiated between First Nations as individual entities and the jurisdiction that's developed over their territory. So I guess we're reconfiguring our ideas about what treaty means and about what nationhood means and what sovereign nationhood means before we can even get to the point of negotiating this national agreement. So I actually see a lot more simplicity and potential for significant outcomes in what we're seeing in Victoria, for example, at the moment.
Just listening to what you're saying, though, and given our history and given the way that sovereignty was taken by force and enforced here in Australia as well, is it reasonable to say, Dominic, that we First Nations people in this country will never enjoy the depths of sovereignty that you are still able to express as Maori people in New Zealand, or that the Navajo or Cree or Crow or Apache or Iroquois or Mohawk are able to express in the United States or in Canada, where treaties are founded in a much clearer expression of extant Indigenous sovereignty than it could ever possibly be here.
Well, I think yeah, that explains why what's being attempted is just so difficult and ambitious. But I suppose one could say in response, the fact that something is incredibly difficult is not in itself a reason for not trying. It is instructive to look at New Zealand to see what kinds of things are possible, what kinds of sovereignty are possible. Maori schooling, for example, schooling in the Maori language is reasonably well advanced. There are certainly problems with it. There are inequities in funding and so on. But the principle that Maori kids ought to be able to go to school and learn in the Maori language is well established and for the most part, uncontested. That kind of thing, one can imagine, is possible in some First Nations communities that still have their languages in place. We've seen, for example, just in the last year, the New Zealand government establish a Maori health authority, which will be allocated public funding to purchase primary health services from Maori health providers for Maori populations. Now, that's obviously not the same as being in control of a total health system and ensuring that its total budget is equitably spent and so on. But it is a political instrument that people expect to be quite significant. And that very idea was recommended to the Rudd government back in 2008 and rejected, but that the work has been certainly done, showing how it could work and showing how it could be expected to make a contribution to better health outcomes. So there are those kinds of examples that are important. And as I said before, sovereignty doesn't exist in just one place. It's wherever decisions are made. So if decisions about who gets which bit of the primary health budget need to be made at a certain place, then First Nations people, I think, quite reasonably can say we want to be there.
To bring that back. Sorry, Dominic, I was going to say, you know, coming out of what you were talking about with shared sovereignty, the Uluru Statement, and this is something that Stan's spoken to quite a bit, is an inspiring, generous vision of a nation. To what extent do you believe in that unifying vision? Do you think that it washes over these complexities that you've spoken to in more of a political sense, or do you think that it's still a worthwhile document in and of itself for nation building?
Well, I think it's worthwhile in and of itself because you've got to have a general philosophical foundation, a general set of principles to guide what you want to do in terms of practical politics and what you want practical politics to achieve. Mm. And I think the Uluru Statement makes that very clear. We want a voice. We want treaties because they will recognise our place in this political community, our distinctiveness, and the terms of our relationship with everybody else. And we want truth because we want people to know our story. And we want our story to, I guess, influence where we're going in terms of nation building and providing a foundation for a common nationhood. Now, many people are going to say that's way too ambitious. But if we have no ambition, then we stand still and achieve nothing.
Do you feel, Dominic, that in New Zealand, and I see this in the public expression of common nationhood, be it dual language anthem, haka performed by Pakeha and Māori and any others who are representing a national team, in dual naming of places. Do you believe that in Aotearoa, New Zealand, that you do have a shared idea of the nation?
I think that's still developing, and there's no doubt it's still contested. You know, there are people who argue quite strongly for a single cultural identity as a requirement for participation in the political system. And there's one political party arguing that quite strongly and doing quite well in the opinion polls and likely to be part of any future Conservative government. So there's certainly a view that, you know, we don't want any expression of Māori culture or values or language in our conception of nationhood. Of course, that was the dominant view for many years, and gradually it's diminished in its significance as things like, you know, Māori language schooling advances, as the level of Māori education improves overall. You know, we have 25% of the cabinet is Māori, and those sorts of changes in the way the institutions of state operate are probably fairly well established. They're not secure in that they're always going to be open to challenge and threat, but they're probably not going to go away either.
Just finally, Dominic, you know, we're seeing that this debate, and I mean the debate, is becoming increasingly fractured, and there's more and more weight being put on, you know, public figures like Stan in this space, who are First Nations people having to speak out against the clamour. What is the one thing that you would like our listeners to keep in mind as they venture further into this debate throughout the coming year?
Well, that we all have a right to contribute to the society in which we live, to share in the setting of the values that it holds, to share in its policy-making processes, and to expect that our voice counts as much as anybody else's. And I think the voice to Parliament makes a contribution.
I'd add to that, to quote you back to yourself in one of your books, that we're still here and we're not going away.
That's right. Yep. We are all here to stay, meaning that, you know, while the state is here and we need to acknowledge that and work with that and accept the good and the bad of that, as First Nations people, we're here and we're not going anywhere either. And the state needs to not accommodate that in terms of theories of liberal accommodation and stuff like that, but accept it as a matter of right. We're here as of right, not by anybody else's benevolence.
As a matter of right.
It's a lovely point to finish on. Dominic, it's terrific. You know, we don't hear this enough in our public discourse. The minute the word sovereignty is mentioned, people go to the barricades, and you've managed to bring us out onto open ground. So we appreciate that. Thank you, Dominic.
Thank you, Dominic.
Thank you very much.